All right, I thought I would try something really different. We were all told in the beginning that we should have maybe four slides to show for one of these little presentations. So I've actually made up four slides. And I think that may be the first. Okay, so I want to say a few words about alpha suppression. This is a topic that I got interested in as a result of a couple of papers by Grushinov and Diamond back in the mid-90s. And it took me a little while for it to sink in. So my own interest in this dates actually back to about 2001. I've been talking about alpha suppression as a consequence of magnetic helicity conservation, even though the words magnetic helicity do not, I think, appear anywhere in the papers by Grushinov and Diamond. So first of all, as an astrophysicist, I believe in my heart that resistivity is a tiny little infinitesimal thing which can be thrown out under most circumstances. Which means I don't do, I guess, planetary dynamos at all. But so this is the version of the induction equation that I like. It's much shorter than the usual page and a half that plasma physicists like. And if you start from this point, then it turns out that there is a gauge-dependent topological quantity, the magnetic helicity, the vector potential dotted into the magnetic field, which obeys a simple conservation equation where this current has a trivial piece here, just the bulk motion of the magnetic helicity, and a non-trivial piece here, which if you wanted to think of this in geometric terms, we're talking about the magnetic helicity as an expression of the spiraling of a magnetic field line. And this term is equivalent to what you would do if you took a rope and you did a motion like this with your hand, creating oppositely oriented spirals moving away from your hand in opposite directions. And that, of course, is a net current of helicity along the rope. Now, the interesting thing that can be done with this is we can do the usual filtering scale, or if you like, in the extreme form, just pretend there are only two scales that interest us, some large scale and some eddy scale. And you associate two different pieces of the magnetic helicity with each scale. These are both large-scale quantities, but here's the magnetic helicity embedded in eddies, and here's the magnetic helicity embedded in the large-scale current. And when you express the equations there, you find that the large-scale piece and the small-scale piece are trading off power between them, and that power is expressed in terms of the magnetic field dotted into the electric field, which is, in other words, the critical piece of dynamo activity. And so there's a very tight connection between how dynamos operate and the transfer of magnetic helicity between scales. And then, of course, you have some complicated current associated with each one. So now, this piece here, this equation here, has a very simple interpretation, which is if we assume we're in some saturated situation as far as the small-scale magnetic helicity goes, so that this time derivative is negligible, and if we further assume that this flux is zero, which is kind of a strange thing to do, but can be zero, then we get a constraint which says that the dynamo activity essentially vanishes up to some resistive order. And for the purpose of this talk, I don't care exactly what resistive order comes into it. So this is a kind of anti-dynamo theorem, and this was the form that was in the papers by Grushinov and Diamond. Well, except that they implicitly threw out this piece. Now, we can get a little bit more physical insight into where this magical anti-dynamo constraint comes from if we think about how to expand the electromotive force. Now, there's a conventional linear expansion, which looks like this, and you can just take this as the definition of alpha and beta. But, of course, there's a long history of how to evaluate this alpha matrix. And the way that I like, and since David Hughes isn't here, we all have to channel his spirit for a moment to remember the drawbacks of this. But the way I like to look at this is that you don't know what this cross product is, but one way of estimating it is taking the time derivative, retaining the bits that are linear in B, so you're looking at alpha, and multiplying by correlation time. and that gives you a rough estimate of V cross B, and in particular alpha, and you get something that looks like this, which has a kinematic piece, a kinetic piece, and a magnetic piece. And if you take the trace of these things, this becomes V dot omega, kinetic helicity, and this becomes V dot J, the current helicity.
What equation are you using for dV by dt?
I'm using the force equation, and I'm imposing incompressibility. Yeah. So I take the magnetic.
Force is playing a part in this.
Right, absolutely. The dV by dt, you get this if you put in a magnetic tension term on the right-hand side of it.
And it's implicit as well as perfectly conducting, clearly.
This is a star or an accretion disk or the interstellar medium or something. It's a good astrophysical setting. Okay, so this piece is related to the current helicity, which of course is not the magnetic helicity. The magnetic helicity is gauge dependent. This thing isn't. But if you have a lot of magnetic helicity, then there's a relationship between the magnetic helicity and the current helicity. And the magnetic helicity is in some sense physically meaningful if that relationship is very localized as possible, which implies something about the preferred gauge that you'd like to be working in. I think Kandu will have a lot more to say about this. But the suppression of alpha is actually due to the accumulation of current helicity. That's not a conserved quantity. Magnetic helicity is a conserved quantity. And if you use this gauge choice, that is basically the Coulomb gauge, then what you find is that B dot A is a very close relationship to B dot J. And with that gauge choice, when you have a lot of magnetic helicity, you have locally a lot of current helicity. So if you build up magnetic helicity, you build up current helicity. If you build up magnetic helicity in that gauge, you build up current helicity, and you get a back reaction on the dynamo. And that's actually what's turning the dynamo off. So let me make a few comments here, things that I think are important to keep in mind. This is expressed as alpha suppression, but that's actually a little bit misleading. The constraint is something that, in the absence of a magnetic helicity current, will tend to drive the parallel component of the electric field to zero, and it really doesn't matter how you're driving it. So you don't have to be driving it through an alpha term. You can be driving it through any term. There will be a back reaction that comes in from the magnetic helicity, and it will turn off the dynamo effect, all things being equal. And in particular, if you have turbulent diffusion in the parallel direction, this will turn that off also. You make this into a way to drive a dynamo as opposed to a kind of anti-dynamo theorem by remembering that you have the possibility of a magnetic helicity flux. Now, if you look at the symmetries of the magnetic helicity flux, it even powers in magnetic field and it's even powers in length scale. So you can have a non-zero magnetic helicity flux even if you have mirror symmetric turbulence. You're needing to break a few symmetries to get a magnetic helicity flux, but it turns out the differential rotation by itself breaks the necessary symmetries. So whereas to get an alpha term through kinematic helicity, you need to have symmetry breaking in three directions. You only need two, given to you automatically by differential rotation, to get a magnetic helicity flux. The other thing is, alpha suppression is frequently expressed as something that shuts off any possibility of a dynamo. It's really an exaggeration. It's something that sets in once little h is built up a bit, which means in practical terms that if you're trying to drive a dynamo through, say, kinematic helicity, this is something that will turn off the dynamo before you get to equipartition, but it won't turn it off, you know, orders and orders of magnitude below equipartition, typically. It's a question of how separate the scales are. And in general, you're turning off the dynamo when the ratio of the large scale field to the eddy scale magnetic field in magnitude is something like the ratio of the length scales, but not it can be less than that, actually, in alpha omega diamond. And then one more point. The way this works is that you're building up local magneticalicity, which is a scalar. And its expression in the dynamo, in the induction equation, is going to come about through a matrix. And so exactly what it does besides suppressing the parallel component of the magnetic field is something that can be hard to figure out, but the effects will be large. And if we want to understand the evolution of a dynamo, we have to keep that in mind. And that really is it. See? Four slides.
Four claps.
But the idea here is that we use up all the time I freed up by getting some discussion from the audience.
Okay, perhaps this is an unfair question, so I'll ask it. So you you neglected the diffusivity. Some people might say that's throwing out the baby with the bathwater. We know that you cannot have a dynamo without the diffusivity. So all your results are in this funny limit where there is no dynamo.
I haven't.
Comment on the fact that when you have some diffusivity, you don't have a conservation law for A dot B.
Okay, no problem. I'm assuming an infinitesimal diffusivity, which is very different from saying a zero diffusivity.
Well, you neglected it in your equation, in all your equations.
That's true, because in all the diffusivity matters if it's the only non-zero piece in there.
So then I'll ask the question. So given your evolution equation for A dot B, and you have the diffusivity there, we know that conservation of A dot B must be broken somehow.
Yeah, if you
and
have
the question is,
right.
Time scale.
If you, it is a question of time scale. If you have magnetic diffusivity important enough to allow reconnection, then that guarantees to you, for example, that it can be large in a fraction of the volume, which is essentially of measure zero. It depends on the magnitude of the resistivity. But you get all the fast reconnection you want and all violation of magneticalicity conservation, but only in a fraction of the volume of order zero.
But some people would argue that it's that reconnection that allows you to have the dynamo in the first place.
Actually, I do believe that reconnection is necessary for the dynamo, but you can't have fast dynamos without restricting that effect to a fraction of measure zero of the volume. And you can't break magneticalicity conservation unless you're breaking, unless resistivity is important over a finite fraction of the volume. So I think that's sort of a theorist's answer. And then the practical answer is, if you look at a laboratory experiment where resistivity is not zero, but not huge, then you find that magneticalicity is much better conserved than energy, which I think is a good empirical proof that, in fact, the bulk conservation of magneticalicity works pretty well.
With the caveat that these things are at low RM.
These things are at low RM. However, I think that you can't understand the dynamics of stars or accretion disks or the interstellar medium in terms of the magnetic field unless there is fast reconnection happening in a fraction of the volume of order zero.
Right.
I mean, there's a certain symmetry in these equations that if you get down to the appropriate scales, V and B are always coming in with opposite signs, I mean, even when there are terms that are quadratic. And you saw that in the expression there. And an Alphane wave, of course, they are exactly equal and opposite. And so you would or equal to each other, depending on the polarization of the Alphane wave. So you might expect all terms to vanish. I think that to the extent that alphanization does occur, it will kill the magneticalicity flux, and it will kill the V cross B. But strictly speaking, you're only going to get alphanization when things like the shear on the volume are negligible. And of course, when the shear on the volume is negligible, you already know right off the bat that the magneticalicity flux is zero because it no longer has a direction that's special. So I think the whole business of alphanization in the MHD turbulent cascade is a pretty good clue that you're being dominated by sort of eddy scale transport terms, which, that is to say, the largest scale terms, the ones that are most affected by things like a global shear. But that's okay. You don't really want to keep track of everything that goes on in very small scales. You'd like to be able to throw it out.
So you described a picture of sort of simultaneous growth of the large scale magnetic fields, or growth of the magnetic field, and transport of helicity to small scales, which saturates and turns off the dynamo. Is that sort of, well, I mean, maybe misquoting you, but is that sort of pointing the way towards an intermittent dynamo?
No, I think there are a couple different things mixed up in that description. So let me clarify what I'm thinking about here. Magnetic helicity is being transported both spatially and between scales. And it's the transport between scales that is the dynamo process. Transport spatially is what allows you to avoid the saturation, the alpha suppression. So if you have a vigorous magnetic helicity flux, then alpha suppression never comes into it. In fact, it's the magnetic term in V cross B and alpha that drives the dynamo. And so I don't think there's any direct implications for an intermittent dynamo at all. It may or may not exist, but it's not tied to this.
So in a system where you don't have separation of scales, for example, can you see anything like this actually going on? Separation of scales just an artifice, or is it
essential? No, look, separation of scales in its extreme version is something that you can apply in general. That is to say, you can always filter out structure below a certain scale. And you can always talk about the transfer of conserved quantities between scales across some arbitrary filtering boundary that you say. So when we say that we have separation of scales, we mean that, you know, a small scale quantity multiplied by a large scale quantity is always a small scale quantity, whereas in real life it's somewhat ambiguous when you have a continuous range of scales. And the thing about having nice scale separation is that it allows you to evaluate terms pretty cleanly. If you don't have very good scale separation, like in a computer simulation, then what you find is that things that you evaluate on the assumption that a small scale piece times a large scale piece is always a small scale piece, for example, that kind of approximation is no longer absolutely true. And instead of getting exact equalities, you get correlations between things. But the basic physical process doesn't change dramatically. It, you know, becomes a little fuzzy. And at the point that you have a smooth range of scales where dynamics is important on all scales, then the sort of calculational shortcuts we like to take when we do these averagings can be kind of misleading.
So what would you say about the flow of helicity in a scale-independent way? I mean, if you just have some turbulent...
I would say that magnetic helicity tends to accumulate at the largest scales, and it tends to do so because there's a direct coherent interaction, which is non-local in Fourier space, between the magnetic helicity in structures at smaller scales and at larger scales. And that's what tends to give you the flow of magnetic helicity to larger scales. But it's not, I'm sorry.
I was just about to, is that a dynamic statement you're making?
I'm making a dynamic statement. And of course, it's not an absolute statement because, you know, there's some preferred balance of magnetic helicity as a function of scale. If magnetic helicity becomes small enough on small scales, you're going to get a forward cascade of it. But in general, systems tend to prefer to orient themselves so that you have more magnetic helicity at larger scales. I think, you know, my own take on that is there's an energetic reason for it, which is to say it takes less energy to express magnetic helicity if you express it at the largest possible scales. But that's kind of handy.
I just wanted to make a comment to Ellen's thing that sometimes it's possible to separate things not by scale, but by the sense of the helicity. Suppose you break up things into helical waves, for example. If you start Fourier transforming, breaking up into small k and large k, suppose you break it into positive helical waves and negative helical waves. Then at least in the try to drive things from the kinematic helicity kind of stuff, then what you tend to find is that the small scales, so to speak, has got one side of these helical fields, and then what you could call as large scale and opposite side because of this transfer of helicity between scales. So although there may not be two clear peaks well separated between these scales. If you break it up in this way, you may find these two guys a little bit separated. Sometimes that happens. That's another way of separating things instead of by just separating just small k and large k, by just the symmetry property of the field.
Is that because you want to cross over the city, so you need to have one sign and the other on the other side?
You can see the sign separation.
There's always a slight difficulty in reconciling the result that you have for alpha involving the UU and the BB terms with the what I might call the classical expression for alpha, which just involves UU, and admits the possibility that U itself may depend on B, the large square of B, through the Lorentz force. And I think, in that situation, you just, of course, get U dot curl U times a correlation time. It equals alpha times a V0, and the alpha may be a function of V0. Now, I think your way of looking at it is very valuable. It does show this suppression effect of magnetic helicity. On the other hand, the interpretation of the U dot curl U term then needs care, because the question is whether it's the U before the field grows, the given U at the beginning of the dynamo process, or the U that is modified and itself suppressed.
Can I just say, another interesting issue is what happens at the correlation time when you have a field?
Sure.
When it changes from the kinematic value.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes.
Both these issues I will at least touch upon.
I'm going to defer to Kandu. How's that for a graceful response?
Nobody has a question. I have one question. So you...
Okay, sure.
I think in this representation with U curl U and E curl B, you have the actual values of U and B. In the other one, you call the classic representation, you have the values in the past and also at other points in space. But these two are representations are equivalent. Yeah. With each other. Okay, which he mentioned with U curl U and B curl B has an additional assumption or an additional approximation. But basically, they are equivalent.
So this discussion we had, where without considering boundary condition and potential flux of magnetic helicity, which will certainly offset this balance you were describing, and so your time derivative. And in the sand, we clearly see that of 10, is ejecting magnetic helicity. You can see that magnetic cloud. So you could wonder to which point actually CME is for the sun or not a way for him to rebuild or to reconfigure his magnetic helicity and topology inside.
Well, I think it's a very deep topic, so let me just give you a very superficial response.
Can we do that for APG2?
In my 2001 paper with Cho, I worked out a simple example of how this might work, where you have a magnetic helicity flux and you allow that to drive a dynamo. And what I found was that I could write down a simple model of an alpha omega dynamo, and it had a curious feature, which is that the magnetic field, was periodic and reversed every half wavelength, but the magnetic helicity flux always pointed in one direction in the periodic domain. It sort of came in the other side with the same value, and the small scale magnetic helicity flux and the large scale magnetic helicity flux would add to a single constant value. So what it was describing was an alpha omega dynamo where there was magnetic helicity moving parallel to the spin axis through the system. Now, real systems, if that very naive model is a fair approximation to reality, and I can't guarantee that, then you would expect that a real astrophysical system with a successful dynamo has a magnetic helicity current flowing through it parallel to the spin axis. And that means, of course, that on either side, it being non-periodic, it's got to be ejecting magnetic helicity of one sign from one hemisphere and the other sign from the other hemisphere in order for the dynamo to work successfully. So I would say, you know, people have said that dynamos have to work by ejecting eddy scale magnetic helicity. I would say, actually, it doesn't matter how the helicity they eject is expressed. It can be large, it can be small, but it does have to be ejected from the boundaries of the system for a successful dynamo to be operating in the system. So I think that means I agree with you.
That's something we want to test at any with Axel and others to set up, and so perhaps that could be a subject of discussion, to check conditions where you have dynamo action, at least numerical dynamo, with boundary conditions that prevent magnetic helicity expulsion, and we do see or notice, perhaps look at that already with Axel. But this, the other thing I wanted to address quickly is the fact that the observers define a relative magnetic helicity by subtracting the contribution that will be the reconstruction, the potential field reconstructed from the structure we are seeing at the surface. So I think there is a way to define a magnetic helicity such that it's gauge invariant to some extent, you know?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, implicitly, when you're talking about little h bound up in small scale structures, there, if you can make the requirement that, you know, contributions from far outside your volume have to vanish quickly, then that is a way of making it gauge invariant, which it's not rigorous, but I think it's equivalent in the rigorous limit to what you were just saying.
The difficulty with relative helicity is that it's very difficult to define a density of relative helicity. So it's again a good thing when you have boundaries and you want the total volume. But suppose you want to say that there is some amount of relative helicity per unit volume here, and that goes away somewhere else. It's very difficult to do that. So I thought about it a bit, but it's not.
Right. I mean, basically, there is no clean solution to this because the magnetic helicity is a topological quantity, and it involves how you extrapolate beyond the boundaries of your system.
So again,
I think we have to move on.
I kind of go off in a different thing. So it might make more sense if you go.
Yes. Okay. The continuity. Yeah. Thank you.
We used to cast the baton, now it's the plug.
And the microphone.
Yes, excuse me. I wouldn't want the comments I make while I'm sitting in the corner to be recorded.
It's quite good. It can almost pick up the questions.
Do you know how to...
Do you want to see your screen too?
No, this is fine.
Can you put the microphone on?
Yeah.
Great.
Thank you. I think there was a pointer somewhere, but there it is. Right, so I probably will have a little more than the four slides, but I hope to do the not. But that number is also misleading at the corner. So these are all the guys who are involved in many of the things which I've been doing. Axel Brandenburg, Anwar Shukurov, Dmitry Sokolov, and Sharanya Sur is my graduate student doing PhD, and he's also involved in some of this stuff. So let me first start by this question, that when I first started thinking about magnetic helicity, it looked to me quite a difficult thing to be able to define it in a gauge invariant way. And this is something which I kept worrying about when I saw papers by Cleurin and company, by Ethan, and although everything seemed plausible, I always had this puzzle in my head. So in the Newton Institute, as Steve would remember, I first started by giving a talk on working with, directly with J.B, because that seemed to be the important thing. And I was always unhappy about that. By the end of that program, I realized that that could be improved to talk about A.B. So this is a way of trying to define a density of magnetic helicity. And you should take a step back from all that you have learned about A.B, and you should go back to Keith Moffett. A paper long time back, I hope that's the right, where you define the magnetic helicity in terms of its topological characteristic as the links between field lines. So this is the Gauss linkage formula if you take two curves, and then you can do the same thing with any two flux tubes, and this is basically it. And I've just put small b because eventually I'll concentrate on the small scale helicity. Now, a magical thing about this formula is that it's a six-dimensional integral. Because you're being a topological thing, you sit here, you count every possible link, pairs of points that you have, so you're integrating over six-dimensional space. But in case of a random field, you can simplify it very easily, because suppose you took a field which was random and it had a correlation function given by Mij, which depended on a small on the separation between these points, x and y, and also on the mean distance, capital R. And suppose the field was random, but it was inhomogeneously varying on a larger scale length. So you have a two-scale kind of situation. So in that case, your correlation scale is much smaller than, let's say, the system scale. Then this six-dimensional integral over d cubed x, d cubed y can be transformed into a six-dimensional integral over d cubed small r and d cubed capital R. And then, if you look at the expression, this is the same thing which I've done. If you look at the expression inside the square brackets, it does not contribute to the integral beyond the correlation scale. So this allows you to think of a density of helicity, that if you look at this guy in the square bracket as a density, then what it measures for you is the density of correlated links that you have. So you stand here, and you just see what are all the links which are correlated to me. And then there is a certain correlation length beyond which you will no longer have a correlation from here to those links. So you count all those links, divide by the volume that you have a density. You go somewhere else, and you will have a different number for those number of links. So you can have the number of correlated links weakly varying slowly with distance, and you can have a density of this thing. So now you have a density of helicity, so you can define a flux of this thing. So you would imagine that this thing makes everything much more complicated, but actually everything is fairly simple. These MIJs depend only on the magnetic field, and the important thing about magnetic helicity is that its dynamics is governed purely by the induction equation and not by anything else. So if you want to work out its dynamics, now, here again, I found some classic paper by Roberts and Soward. Andrew. To be extremely useful, because what they did was they did this two-scale Fourier transform, where you do a Fourier transform over small k and capital K, and that allows you to systematically work out the algebra, because when you're talking about a flux, what you're doing is a spatial transport of helicity density, which means you are keeping one large-scale derivative of the helicity density. And so you can do that systematically, and you can now get a local helicity conservation equation. So this kind of avoids all the ambiguity about what gauge you should use. In fact, the closest thing is the Coulomb gauge, and I always admire Ethan because he always thinks of the right thing without doing all the algebra. Yes. So in that case, you can define, what turns out to happen is that if you take the density of helicity, it satisfies the conservation law for the small scale helicity density. So you get a dH by dt. It has a volume generation term. I have not completely thrown away the eta term, of course. So So that is a resistive term. And more, very importantly, there's a divergence of a flux. And then you can look at this flux. The flux has various pieces which you can calculate. There's no approximation at this stage. The simplest piece, which Anwar kept emphasizing to me, and finally I agreed with him completely, is just advection. So suppose you have in a system like a galaxy, for example, you always have material going, leaving the system, like in a fountain flow and then coming back. So you can just simply advect magnetic field and its helicity out. Now you may wonder whether this will solve the problem because you're also advecting the mean field with this. But in certain cases, you can solve part of the problem by just simple advection, flux due to advection. There are fairly more complicated fluxes driven by this UB correlations. And in fact, this chi is the two-scale generalization of the turbulent EMF, that is a UB cross-correlation. And the presence of these chis give you additional kind of fluxes, things which Ethan talked about, that you twist stuff and then you move it in different ways. And in fact, you can get the Vishniak and Cho flux out of this term. You can get the Clurian type of fluxes from these terms. And there is also a triple correlation to the flux. The important thing about magnetic helicity compared to, let's say, current helicity, which I worked with before, is that in those cases, the triple correlations come even in the volume term. And in the case of magnetic helicity, the triple correlation first comes and hits you in the divergence of the flux. So obviously you don't know how to do this triple correlation, let alone know how to do this double correlation, until you have a closure kind of model. So for now, all that I will say is kind of, there is a reservation that we don't know completely too much about the triple correlation at present. And of course, this is the point which Ethan mentioned, that if you did not have this term and you did not have this term, your parallel component of the electromotive force is completely dependent upon eta j dot b. I would like to make one particular point, is that if you look at this equation, there is this unknown triple correlation. There are these two UB correlations. In principle, all these could be zero. Okay, so you could have everything. So it looks like to make everything work, you need to start somewhere. You need to start out somewhere. So in my frame of reference, I have not yet completely convinced myself that if the bulk flux was zero, then you could actually get everything going, the helicity currents going in a proper way. But it may be true, of course. Now, if you want to put this to any use, right, then you have to solve, you have to impose this helicity conservation as a dynamical constraint. Okay? And you have to solve it, for example, with a mean field model, with a mean field kind of model. This, of course, all that I have said in the previous two slides is completely something which nobody can argue with because it's something which is predicated only on algebra. But once you start putting it in a mean field model, then of course we will discuss whether this is valid, whether you have an alpha, you don't have an alpha. So I'd just like to make a few comments. For example, this already Ethan has mentioned that you typically could write, for example, the equation with the kinetic and a magnetic alpha related to the current density. And already Keith has asked, is there a magnetic alpha? And Karl Heinz has also. And Steve has asked about the tau. Now, there is one calculation which we did where being bothered about this question about with Keith Moffat raised through maybe Proctor and also Karl Heinz and Reinhardt, is that we said, let's take a situation where you can actually calculate everything. So you take a situation where the magnetic Reynolds number is very small and the fluid Reynolds number is also very small. Then you can put the Lorentz force in the momentum equation. You can do first order smoothing. You can do this perturbation kind of linear calculation in both the induction and the momentum equation. And you can solve for everything, the alpha, completely in terms of the forcing that you put. It could be time dependent, it could be time independent. Then what we find is that if you start with the induction equation and go through the normal route, then the alpha can be expressed in terms of a UU helical correlation, as you'll find in the book of Moffat or Karl Heinz.
On the other hand, if you start with a momentum equation, you will find that the alpha, because you solve for the small u from the momentum equation, and then you take u cross b, then you'll find the alpha can be expressed in terms of the force magnetic field correlation, because the forcing term, and the BB correlation from the Lorentz force. Of course, these two are the same because finally you can solve everything in terms of the forcing, substitute and find exactly the same answer for alpha, and suppressed as 1 over B cubed in the Moffat case, or 1 over B squared, in fact, in the delta correlated case. But then if you neglect the Lorentz force, this piece will go away, and this guy will match in the kinematic limit. If you put the Lorentz force, this guy will look like the original kinetic alpha, but suppressed in amplitude. So it looked, at least in this particular context, you can either think completely in terms of a kinetic alpha effect, or you can think in terms of a slightly suppressed kinetic corrected by a magnetic alpha effect. Of course, this is not saying that this will hold in the large RM situation, but this is one place where you can do a calculation, and you can see that am I being inconsistent with what is the traditional thinking about the alpha effect, and you are not. And also, in the large RM, a talk which I heard long time back by Pat, and I thought he would be here, but
he's stranded in San Diego.
Okay, he's stranded. It was a very interesting talk about, I think we were both trying at that stage to placate Mike Proctor in different ways. I did not succeed until much later in trying to do this, but Pat was trying to placate Proctor right then. But of course, Proctor didn't get placated. That at least I asked when I asked him. So he said he did a different approach. He said that suppose instead of, as usual, people think that you need to find yourself dynamical equation for the spectra, and then you assume a time correlation time in the EDQNM or any other closure, or things which he had himself done long time back. Instead of that, you rather think in terms of having the spectra and then looking at the dynamical response of introducing a mean field, then all your nasty stuff will go into the correlation time, which you so far just said was just a constant time tau. And in fact, in the 2D case, similar to the alpha suppression, you have the turbulent diffusion suppression, where u squared gets cancelled by a b squared, and this is something which Shane will talk about much more in detail. And this structure comes in the correlation time, effective correlation time, or as Pat always likes to put it, in the cross phase between the u and the b. That is, u itself is not suppressed, b itself is not suppressed, but some u cross b stuff is being suppressed. And so there is this phase which is suppressed. So in this particular case, if you kind of got rid of the b squared by hook or by crook, then you may be able to get out of this suppression. Such a calculation has not been done, as far as I know, and I've been trying to interest Pat for the 3D case, but I would imagine that something which will come and kill any alpha effect will also be something which depends upon parity non-invariance, so it would be something which depends upon the helical kind of stuff associated with the magnetic field. Although there will be, so that will be similar to this cross-phase suppression, but that's something all I can say here. So basically the conclusion is that it's good to transport away helicity or by a flux to prevent, as Ethan emphasized, E-parallel suppression or not alpha suppression. So I should almost be... So we can run a few mean field dynamo models. For example, in the galactic case, without this advective flux, the mean field will decay to very small values. And if you put small amount of advective flux, you could saturate it at some particular value, which is of order one, few times smaller than the equipartition, as you can see here. If you put too much advection, you throw away the baby with the bath water and everything will decay. Okay, so there is a regime of advection here. And recently there was a paper on the galactic dynamo simulation by Elsner and Rudiger and people where they try to use this thing, but also saying that there could be a gamma effect of bringing the field back into the disk, the mean field. So if you do something different to the mean field than just this advection, then you could do this. Just a few comments about those fluxes which involve chi. They're all zero if you have isotropy and if you have the velocity and magnetic correlations are equal. But shear actually breaks this strict thing between the velocity and magnetic fields, because the way shear acts on the velocity field and the way shear acts on the magnetic small-scale magnetic field come with a different sign here. So it's possible for shear to not have the usual quenching when you say kinetic minus magnetic. These two may not cancel if you have shear. But some calculation is needed for this. This is our version of Vishniak and Cho flux with Axel and myself. Again, it involves all these taus, which if they're all suppressed, then you are nowhere. And I don't know whether Ethan has ever seen this. So you can write it actually as a B cross shear dot B. Okay. You can look at it later. So one thing which we did find when running these mean field models is that the Vishniak-Cho flux seems to require a finite amplitude before it grows the mean field, before it takes off. So these are some numerical calculations of Sharanya, Anwar. Don't worry too much about it. I wanted to just end with this. Right. This is the symbol of Ayuka, which our director, founding director, very presciently chose. Okay, this is our symbol. So this is Inter-University Center for Astronomy and Astrophysics. And if you actually look, draw an arrow through all this, okay, and count the helicity, there are four positive links and there are four negative links. And actually, helicity is zero for this structure. Right? So now, really speaking, what is being, I mean, I can go at length at what this means for the politics of an institution. But if you think about helicity, right, at the bottom of this is this conservation of magnetic flux. That is, you, except for resistance, there's no way to, the flux freezing, except for resistivity, there is no way to change the flux in a Lagrangian volume. That's at the bottom of helicity conservation at some level. And so we are missing, of course, all these kind of stuff. And so maybe Keith Moffat should think about how to characterize all these quantities and can one, incorporate such things in dynamos.
Be careful about internal twist in that flux tube as well.
Oh, yeah. I'm assuming there is just a non-twisted, untwisted, but linked flux tube. But it has zero helicity. But it's obviously something, if the field gets into this configuration, you are not going to describe it by any of these equations we have at present, except the induction equation, of course.
But the Olympic symbol has helicity.
Yes, it has only three rings, or five rings.
Five rings.
Five rings, yes. Okay, I finished, sorry.
You had this nice topological way of talking about magnetic helicity. When people talk about magnetic helicity in papers, they usually plot a spectrum. So can you, I never really understand what a spectrum of magnetic helicity means. Can you explain?
Well, this particular thing, of course, see, what this thing is important for is if there are no way to get spectra. For example, if you have a periodic box, then of course you could always argue that you can define it in a gauge invariant way because of this periodic thing. Then you can have spectra, in that case, A dot B would be itself okay in some sense because everything is periodic and the boundary conditions is not. So this thing actually is more relevant if you do not have periodic boxes. And then you have to try to, we have not just exploited it greatly to calculate this fellow in simulations at present. Yes, I agree. But we have been sticking to periodic boxes to some extent. But yes, it would be interesting not only to, also to observe, you may not need all the components to calculate it in observations. For example, if you are on the surface of the sun and you want to do this calculation of helicity on the surface of the sun, of course it's a non-local quantity, you have to integrate, right? So you need to integrate more than some correlation scales of the structure. But it's something which just depends on the field. So it's maybe an interesting thing. We haven't thought too much about it, but we just mentioned it, for example, in this paper. It may be possible to try to estimate this in the solar surface. Because people usually use the Berger field approach, where you have to do all this potential reconstruction and it's...
To answer Steve's question, with the, if you take a knotted flux tube, the helicity would be in the large scale of the tube, but we can pull the knot tight. And now the helicity is all in small scale, but there's no helicity in the large scale.
Okay. If you go back to your large scale,
okay, you do have some twist on your
belt. Yeah, a little twist.
You take a, I mean, this is what I was kind of confusing. If you take a Fourier transform of your belt, mm-hmm. there's a sharp edge here, which means there's quite a lot of
power on small scale.
Power response at small scale.
Look, you can make a flux tube with a nice smooth Gaussian cross section. I agree there's still some small scale stuff there, but the peak is.
I mean, I like this interpretation. I don't like power spectrum. For the reason I already said. So I'm much happier with cameras.
I think this remark is actually related to what you said, and maybe it's directed to Ethan as well. So you seem to be assuming that you don't form coherent structures in which there's a lot of local dissipation, like card sheets or vortex.
Well, so this whole thing relates to the fact that how good is helicity conserved? And I think Ethan already said some comments about that. So there are various arguments. For example, if you see Berger's papers, he has these arguments saying that the helicity is better conserved than energy because even when you reconnect, you may not change that much of the helicity. You have experiments. If you look at spectra, then J dot B itself blows up with Reynolds number. If you take an isotropic spectra, of course, it depends upon the slope, but if you took a Kolmogorov slope kind of thing for the B, and if you took K times that for the J, then you will find that J dot B goes as, I think, Reynolds number to the 1/4 power. It blows up. But eta J dot B then still goes to 0 in this particular case with RM because eta goes as 1 over RM. This blows up as RM to the 1/4. So it may depend in specific situations. And the other situation which first was brought to my head by Andrew Sobert, although you don't remember this question which he asked me last time, is that if you have an eigenfunction of the kinematic dynamo with helicity, everything grows exponentially, including the helicity. Okay, so that, of course, you may think, you know, what is being conserved? But, of course, there is the helicity is still growing with eta multiplying it. So there is a small parameter there, and there could be, if you have a mean field coming out of this, there could be transfer of helicity between scales measured by the E dot B, which has a larger constant in front of the exponential. So this has to be quantified more, but there are various situations where it's a complicated thing.
I have the following difficulty. Consider the mean electromotive force, consider the magnetic part of the alpha term. In general, it can be represented by derivatives of small b and small b itself. In an isotropic case, you have j dot b. And then you can argue, okay, j dot b is related to a vector potential. Dot B, and then you can apply what you know about helicity.
Yes.
But in the known isotropic case,
yes.
Yeah, also known isotropic cases,
of course,
in nature, you have not the connection to G dot B, and how you can then argue with helicity arguments?
Yeah. Okay. I thought a little bit about this question. So there are two responses. First is that whatever is your EMF, the helicity equation is valid, okay? So what all that it will tell you is that the parallel component of the electromotive force without any of these currents will be resistively governed at some level. That's what the helicity conservation equation will tell you. Whatever, however complicated is your EMF, the practical point of how to couple this to a mean field dynamo equation is depending upon the fact that you have exactly this isotropy kind of stuff. But, I mean, if you could solve the mean field dynamo equation and the Navier-Stokes equation, that's it. I mean, you don't need to talk about helicity at all, ever, because that contains everything. It's just trying to short circuit all the all the fact that you're, at least the equation with the Lorentz force is so complicated that you may gain some insight by looking just at the version of the induction equation. So I think the helicity conservation arguments will still be valid, but to make it to practical use will be more difficult. And then you may have to go back to something else.
Do you need to move on? It's short, I'm okay. Sorry. Now, if it's short, okay.
It's very short. I just wanted to say that in the case of strongly anisotropic turbulence, you still have some relationship between the tensor and the magnetic field and the magnetic helicity. It's just that, you know, it's like multiplying some scalar by a matrix which is dependent on the characteristics of the turbulence. And there's no global answer to that, but there may be some useful ansatzes.
So we have to move on, but we can certainly discuss that at the end.
All right. So I'm going to talk about a slightly different but related problem, certainly falls under the rubric of quenching or suppression. In this case, I'm interested in two-dimensional quenching of resistivity or magnetic diffusivity. And I'm going to look at the connection between quenching and irreversibility in a model problem which is closely related to two-dimensional magnetohydrodynamics, what I call wavy magnetohydrodynamics, and I'll explain what I mean by that. This is work I've conducted with Patrick Diamond, who's in San Diego today. He couldn't make it. But also I've had some help and benefited from discussion with some of these people here. Now, the question I want to address is how robust, in a sense, is resistivity quenching? Here I'm going to use the term eta T to represent turbulent resistivity. And the answer, the simple answer, of course, is that it's exactly as robust as the Zeldovich theorem, by which I mean the relationship between the turbulent resistivity and the collisional resistivity, the mean squared magnetic fluctuation, and the large-scale magnetic field B average here. This is an exact result, which follows from a number of assumptions, notably stationarity of the turbulent fluctuations, the assumption that the eddy transport is diffuse, which allows me to define a turbulent resistivity in the first place. There's also, I'm going to assume here that there's no surface terms. I'll do that by assuming a periodic boundary conditions. And finally, there is an assumption that there is the B squared spectrum here does not depend upon eta. In other words, it remains finite as eta goes to zero. And that's a consequence of the fact that B is not a passive scalar, or A is not a passive scalar, I beg your pardon. There's also an implicit assumption here, and that is that the only irreversibility in this problem arises from molecular collisions. I'd like to relax that assumption. I'm going to do that by looking at a close analogy, or a close cousin, if you were. I'm Irish, so we have a lot of close cousins. of the two-dimensional problem, and that is wavy magnetohydrodynamic turbulence. And by that, I just mean MHD plus an additional body force. As an example, you could take the Coriolis force, or you could take buoyancy. The effect of these forces is to change the large-scale eddies into dispersive waves. In the case of the Coriolis force, on the large scales, the eddies become Rossby waves. In the case of buoyancy, we get internal gravity waves. So in a nutshell, wavy MHD is just MHD plus dispersive waves. Let me give you a concrete example. Oh, by the way, this is nothing new. You just have to look at some of Keith's early papers. Andy has a paper on random inertial wave interactions, and also a paper by Vanstein and Zeldovich on sound waves in MHD. But let me give you a specific example which I know interests Steve and others, and that is look at two-dimensional MHD turbulence instead of on a flat plane, on a beta plane, by which I mean beta here, of course, has nothing to do with beta in mean field electrodynamics. It also has nothing to do with the plasma beta. This is the geophysical fluid dynamic beta, by which I mean the locally vertical component of the latitudinal gradient and the locally vertical component of the planetary vorticity. In other words, my direction of vorticity is changing as I change latitude. So, what are the equations of motion? I just have my equation for the vorticity. If I introduce a stream function, this is the vorticity. My current can be expressed in terms of a magnetic potential. I have diffusion here. I have a mean field. And I have a new term appearing because of the beta effect. My induction equation has not changed. So this is really the only change to my equations that I've made. I've just changed the linear dynamics. What is the effect of that? Well, if you were to write down what the dispersion relation of this is, it's no longer simply the dispersion relation for Alphane waves. In fact, there's an extra part which comes from Rossby waves, the appearance of Rossby waves here. And so what you find is that if you take the derivative with respect to k, the phase velocity depends upon k. These things are dispersive waves. However, the dispersiveness of the waves, if you like, is dependent upon the wave number. In other words, on the large scales, these things are Rossby waves and hence dispersive waves. But on the small scales, these things are more like Alphane waves and they're non-dispersive. So there's an intermediate scale there. What is the attractive feature? Why am I doing this? Well,
so what decides this transition from the large to the small scale?
I'll show you the effect of it, yes. So, I mean, you can see that this is a very close analogy to 2D magnetohydrodynamic turbulence, but it does change dramatically the nature of the transport. The attractive feature of this problem, and of problems like it, or of systems like it, is that when the wave slope is small, by which I mean the wave number multiplied by a displacement, a wave displacement, when that is a small number, wave turbulence theory is applicable. Now, I'll get into a little bit more about what wave turbulence theory means and when it's appropriate on the next slide. But the sort of key point is that in wave turbulence theory, the origin of irreversibility is ray chaos. Ray chaos induced by multiple overlapping wave resonances. Sorry, I'm standing in your way. That's present even in the infinite magnetic Reynolds number case, that is, without collisions. In other words, we have a source of irreversibility here which is independent of eta. And that's in contrast to the 2D MHD case, where the only source of irreversibility was eta. So in fact, we have a system here with dual asymptotics. I shall be looking at the large magnetic Reynolds number limit, but I will also be looking at the small wave slope limit. Small wave slope, small parameter, I can start to perform perturbation expansions, and I can construct a rigorous, although limited by the size of the wave slope, a rigorous theory which has no unconstrained parameters. In other words, I have no tau appearing here, which you saw in the last two talks, which you can interpret in terms of EDQ and M or however you like. This means that I can actually obtain an analytical result, which can prove, which provides a useful and falsifiable test of the theory of resistivity quenching in a regime where the irreversibility here is unambiguous. So wave turbulence theory describes the slow transfer of energy among a triad of waves satisfying the resonance condition that the wave numbers add up to zero and the wave frequencies add up to zero. It's easy to see that this case is actually analogous to the free asymmetric top, where we have moments of inertia which are not equal. You'll be familiar from your Landau and Lifshitz. This is the Poinsot construction, where I have plots on an ellipsoid in angular momentum space and intersections with a sphere, which correspond to joint conservation of angular momentum, total angular momentum, and total energy. The orbits, therefore, trace out the intersection of those two shapes. And you can show that oscillations about the two stable rotation axes actually stay localized there, but oscillations about the unstable axis of rotation do move around the entire ellipsoid.
And there's a toy to show this?
Precisely, exactly. Well, here's the thing, of course, these things always loop back on themselves, don't they? So this is a periodic. The orbits are periodic. This is reversible motion. And as we saw in the case of Keith, you had to have friction for the thing to stop flipping back and forth. Eventually, it always went back into the unstable moment of or unstable motion. So, to get irreversible motion, you have to have an ensemble of triads. In which case, the origin of irreversibility is ray chaos caused by overlapping wave resonances here. This is similar to deterministic chaos or Hamiltonian chaos, where again there is no dissipation. One final thing. As long as the coherence time of the triad is much smaller than the transfer time, the energy transfer time among members of the triad, I can model the energy transfer as a random walk. To be a bit more specific, wave turbulence theory is limited in that it's only applicable to a broad spectrum of dispersive, weakly interacting waves. We have to have a broad spectrum because we want the triad to remain coherent enough for energy to transfer during the interaction. We want dispersive waves, and this is important, because the resonance condition here is trivially satisfied when omega is a simple function of k, a linear function of k. In other words, the resonance manifold, which is defined by those two conditions, is empty for non-dispersive waves. Finally, we need them to be weakly interacting, by which I mean turbulent decorrelations don't wash out the wave interactions before energy can slowly transfer among them.
I'm sorry, I thought that this resonance manifold is empty for non-dispersive waves. You say that every triad is resonant.
Yes.
So why is it empty? It's completely full.
I think that's just the term of choice.
This is what you mean, yeah, okay.
Yes.
Every triad is resonant.
In a way, yes. Now, this is important, weakly interacting. We need the decorrelation rate to be smaller than the wave mismatch. So let me estimate the decorrelation rate by k times some RMS velocity. Let me estimate the wave mismatch by a wave frequency and divide these two quantities. You can show that this is actually approximately equal to the wave slope. V I can sort of estimate as omega times a displacement. Now, if this is to be much smaller than this, this condition is equivalent to the wave slope being a small number, and hence I get my small parameter in which I'm going to expand. Notice that these two things are actually equal at some wavelength or some length scale, and that length scale in the case of quasi-geostrophic turbulence is known as the Rhine scale, and in the case of internal wave turbulence, it's known as the Osmodov scale, which may or may not be familiar to you. A pictorial representation of what I'm talking about is given here. Here I have my scale dividing non-dispersive waves from dispersive waves. Length scale is increasing this direction, so on the small scales, these things are non-dispersive Alfvén waves. On the larger scales, they are dispersive waves. My crossover scale here, if you like, my Rhine scale, divides strong turbulence on the small scales from weak turbulence on the large scales. Needless to say, the only place where wave turbulence is appropriate is on the larger scales here, where my waves are both dispersive and weakly interacting. On the smaller scales, these things are strongly interacting eddies and Alfvén waves, basically 2D MHT turbulence. On the intermediate scales, we do have dispersive waves, but the interactions of those guys are washed out by turbulence before they can do anything. In other words, in these two regions, irreversible transport is still tied to molecular collisions. However, up here we have a weakening of this tie. We have another channel, if you like, of irreversibility, as I say, from wave resonances. So at least within that large-scale regime, I can start to calculate things. I can write my flux of magnetic potential, vertical flux of magnetic potential, in terms of a response of the field and the flow to wave interactions. You can show that this actually reduces to a contribution coming from, this is the triad term, so it's wave-wave resonances, and molecular collisions here, which is again tied to the collisional resistivity. In the absence of these wave-wave resonances, this term doesn't appear, and we get what you usually get. However, I can start to expand delta A in that small parameter, the wave slope, sigma I'm going to use, which is less than 1. You can show that at order sigma squared, well, this thing has got to go sort of sigma 2, sigma 4, sigma 6, because the nonlinearities are quadratic, and I'm going to make a random phase approximation, which gets rid of all of my odd order moments. At the lowest order, we get nothing. In other words, we're still tied to eta at the lowest order. Quasi-linear theory gives us the usual quenched or suppressed results. The first non-zero contribution comes from the fourth order in wave slope. And you can show that it takes this form. This is my resistivity due to wave-wave interactions to the fourth order. I have a sum over resonant triads. I have a geometrical factor which depends upon the wave numbers of that triad. I have a sort of an interaction coefficient here. I have a response time, theta plus and theta minus, which are given by these, the real part of I over the wave mismatch, which of course becomes simply a delta function, and that gives me another resonance condition. And as advertised, of course, this thing is fourth order in sigma. These interaction coefficients or coupling coefficients are extremely complicated functions of k, k prime, or p, k double prime, or q, and of course omega, omega prime, omega double prime. I've just shown you here to demonstrate that these things don't vanish and are generally positive and have a complicated structure in phase space. The red kidney bean here, solid kidney bean at least, indicates where the resonance condition is met exactly. That can be relaxed by allowing some small width in the mismatch, which gives me my dashed line here. So to summarize, what have I shown? In a nutshell, ray chaos, which is induced by overlapping wave resonances, dispersive wave resonances, drives a diffusive flux of magnetic potential that's independent of the magnetic Reynolds number. It's independent of collision, molecular collisions. So, issues for discussion. What issues does this raise? I think the principal issue it raises is, what is the microphysics of tau? What are we hiding in these ED, Q, and M calculations in our tau, which in a sense is sort of parameterizing the nonlinearities in the theory? Another question is, what is the origin of irreversibility in these kind of calculations and indeed in numerical calculations? Also, we've seen here that there is a subtle connection between the spectral transfer of energy, which is the usual purview of wave turbulence theory, and the spatial transport of magnetic potential, which is the calculation that I've carried out here. They're distinct in principle, but obviously connected. Finally, and perhaps most obviously, what does this say about alpha and if you like, helicity transport? In particular, it's, you know, you could sort of do the same calculation in three dimensions. Do you expect a contribution to come from wave resonances in that case?
You require some sort of microscopic irreversibility.
Precisely, yes.
So if you kept molecular diffusivity in your equations, they would make, you know, you get this k squared eta term, and so you would have dispersiveness even at the small scales due to diffusion.
Dispersiveness from diffusion?
Yeah.
Well, that's not going to appear, well, strictly speaking, no, because when you take these real things of I over blah, this thing, those disappear, if you understand what I'm saying.
Well, I'm not sure I agree, because if you go to really short wavelengths, something like resistivity will critically dip.
Oh, of course. Oh, yes, absolutely. And what I'm saying is basically that, if you like, on the small scales, that is the dominant mechanism. This thing isn't going to play a role at all there. But on the larger scales, what's going to win is the wave, well, I suggest, what's going to win is the wave resonances, because first of all, diffusion plays a much smaller role. And second of all, these things are present even without diffusion.
I guess what I'm asking you is whether diffusion gives you
the dispersiveness that you require. I don't think so, no. It's also not necessary. Did I answer that satisfactorily?
Well, you don't work out
of time. Well, I mean, I...
No, I understand what you said.
But doesn't diffusion set the scale between these two behaviors? The ray chaos and the...
No. No, it doesn't. Those length scales, in the case you can show, in the case of... in the case, so we had sort of two typical length scales. L star was sort of divided, you know, dispersive waves from non-dispersive waves. It's something like, I may have this upside down. You know, there's no diffusion here.
Yeah, there is. I mean, I know there isn't the way you've written it, but there's an alpha in...
Ah, the larger scale. Yes, you're right.
Fluctuating field, which is linked to being occupying the diffusion.
Right, on the larger scale, that's where that comes in.
Right.
So you're right. This could well depend upon diffusion. Yeah. Yes. No, I entirely agree. And there's a sort of a self-consistency concern, right? Because you don't, if you send E to the zero, are you sort of shrinking or growing these scales of a you know? That's you know a perfectly fair.
Yeah.
Observation to make. I think the way to answer that question in a sort of proper is to do a numerical simulation of these things, but it's a trick. I think it's a really tricky parameter space to probe, isn't it?
Well, it's high RM.
It's high RM with small diffusion and.
You need a lot of scales.
Yeah, but it's two dimensional, so that's one saving grace.
Well, energy is conserved by these triad interactions.
Yes.
By each individual triangle. And yet you're calculating a diffusivity which presumably acts on energy and it gives an effective dissipation of energy. Or am I...
Well, no. I mean, look at the case of Hamiltonian chaos. Energy is conserved there, but the phase space trajectories can wander all over the phase space.
Yeah. And what is... Is this just, in spectral terms, transfer to small scale?
It could have either sign, but yes, it's transfer.
Yeah.
It depends on the particular triad which way the transfer goes. Yeah. And it depends upon the particular spectrum what the overall transfer is.
It provides a term in a spectral equation, then, which actually would integrate to zero if you integrate over all k.
One would hope.
And that's the difference between that and the term due to molecular diffusion, for example, which definitely is negative when integrated over all k.
Mm-hmm. It's irreversibility, I suppose. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a question I wanted to ask you. So you started by saying that there were perhaps a quenching of the turbulent eta, and you gave a formula by Zadovich. So how do you modify the formula in the consideration? You just say that we should consider two type of eta t, one...
Yeah, let me think. I guess you would write... Yeah, you probably...
Oh, you loop your target.
Yeah, you do get a new term appearing in the Zeldovich theorem. I don't remember the exact form of it.
So does it mean that there will be quenching or not by these waves interactions?
Well, that depends upon the relative sizes or the importance of those things. You could argue that, you know, in the so-called catastrophic case where you send a magnetic Reynolds number to infinity and you get essentially no contribution coming from molecular diffusion, this is still here, even in that case, in which case this becomes important.
So it means that... So it means that you will have an enhanced diffusivity. Okay, so I guess it's, you get more than what you will get by microscopy.
Yeah, I mean it's similar to the case of sort of Vlasov turbulence, where you have contributions coming from wave-particle interactions, wave-wave interactions, and so on, and higher orders, and you can't necessarily say from the outset which is the most important contribution. You sort of have to calculate each one and then see. Okay. Which is the biggest contribution.
I had the impression that quenching was the problem of having a large scale mean B. How do your large scale mean B interact, get into your work?
Sure. That's fine. So this is the two dimensional problem as opposed to the three dimensional problem. It's okay if I work on the board here. In which case, I think you can write the mean field, the large scale mean field, squared, goes as something like minus eta plus eta t. If I got this backwards, I think that's a squared actually. And this is b squared. Have I got that right? Or?
Yeah.
So it's entering here.
Can I ask you about your shameless speculation?
Oh, yeah, please. Please speculate shamelessly.
No, I don't want to speculate. I want you to elaborate on your shameless speculation.
Go ahead.
You don't have to elaborate. He asked.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, you don't know it's shameless, not shameless.
In principle, this process should work also for, I guess the analogy in three dimensions is transport of helicity.
You just need to write down the corresponding equation for our helicity, 2D or something like it. But it's not, no helicity in 2D.
Yes,
but
no helicity in 2D.
But the same equation probably, but
oh, yes.
Waves would be, again, similar kind of things, velocity waves and...
In fact, I mean, perhaps we can discuss this offline. I'm doing a calculation at the moment, and I can show you some of the things. I don't see any reason why this shouldn't work. I mean, I may be wrong, but that's...
Well, it's 1 p.m. sharp, so I propose we stop, and we thank all the speakers.
Can I just say before everybody goes that...